everybody. Welcome back. This is Henrik from Sweden. Thank you for tuning in today. You are, of course, listening to Red Eyes Radio. Please check out our websites, redeyescreations.com and redeyesmembers.com for much more. We hear a lot about Norway in the most positive light in the international mass media these days, as the globalists want to push a corporate socialist model upon the world. The Scandinavian experiment and the Nordic model has certainly proven to fulfill many of the dreams that the New World Order wants to impose on the world. Astronomical taxes, systemic corruption, a controlled and one-sided media, a silent and submissive population, massive public spending, and in return, we get lousy schools and healthcare not worth even mentioning. There's also within the system no room for alternatives and a few mom and pops, as the corporate socialist model creates more monopolies and conformity than probably any other system has done throughout history. We are talking with Ingunn Sigurdsdottir today, who has been on the fringes of Norwegian society for some time now, a vantage point from where she can see the absurdity of the system and, of course, what happens if you do not obey and submit to the state. She has a university degree in languages and social sciences, living in various countries, has provided a track record of conventional as well as not-so-conventional careers within different areas. She has founded and co-founded three companies, taught at the local university and high schools, and was last running an alternative school in her hometown. She has also co-authored a book for children about Thor Heyerdahl's crossing of the Pacific Ocean in a balsa fleet. We'll be discussing the modus operandi and the underlying nefarious quality of the much-praised Scandinavian social democracies, the engineering of our mind constructs through media and other institutions, and the limits to statism. This is an extended two-hour segment, and in the second hour we'll speak more about when the Norwegian police showed up at her door with the equivalent of the Food Safety Agency in order to stifle her economically, basically. We'll get into some of the history of the Scandinavian countries towards the end as well, as this is where the key lies, both to why we have been so fiercely opposed and sought to be controlled like no other, but it's in the history that the secrets to our rebellion also lie. Hi, Ingunn. Thanks for coming on the program, talking with us today. Everything okay on your end?
Hi there, Henrik. Yes, absolutely. Thank you. So I'm Skyping you from the studio of Michael's Round Table Talk near Oslo, near the Norwegian capital. And what I see around me is an impressive sound studio, actually, and Michael's artwork on the walls. And just like me, we are actually two people in the studio today with you. So like me, Michael is also dedicating most of his time and his efforts and whatever money he might have to waking the people up in times where we see the totalitarian society come closer by the day. So as for me, I have, for instance, not bought clothes in 3 or 4 years. And when I look at Mike, I think that might be the case also for him.
Yeah. Well, hi, Mike. Thank you for joining us as well.
Hello, Henrik.
Hey, nice to talk to you. Nice to meet you. Well, I think we have a really interesting discussion ahead of us here today. And, you know, before we get more into the situation in Norway as well regarding freedom of speech, and I mean, there's so many issues that we can and want to talk about, and we'll see how much we can kind of cram into it here. But maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself, Ingunn. There's an interesting situation that has occurred to you, obviously. We'll get into this more later in detail, but we're going to try to tackle this very notion as well, that Norway is the best country in the world, the world's happiest place to live in. And this is something that's get repeated again and again in the mass media. And, you know, there's some interesting numbers that we can dig out on that as well. But just tell us a little bit about yourself, Ingunn.
Yeah, I'll just give you a general background so you have an idea. So as for me, I feel that I've been descending the social ladder rather than climbing it, actually. So I feel that I began on the top, pretty much. And after that, I've come climbing down for the last few years. So I grew up in a politically conscious family, and my grandfather, he was the head of the leftist party. So he was actually a renowned politician. And career-wise, I've been teaching at the local university and at high schools, and I have founded and co-founded three companies and at least one of them with the fair measure of worldly success. So, but what I do now is that it's the contrary. I'm cleaning houses, for instance, and I have turned in my Norwegian citizenship. So I've become what some might call a free woman, but which is rather just returning to the natural sovereign state, you know, without any tags, really. So what I live by now is my ecological green economy, which the state is very happy to label black money. But as far as me is concerned, I would say that it's the black economy that the state promotes exclusively.
Right.
So when I think about the things that I do now, actually, I think it's so sweet because the allegory fits my life so nicely. So Shakespeare, he says that all the men and women are merely players on the stage, right? And there is only one person who is outside this matrix and who isn't in the game. And that's the cleaning lady, because she comes onto the stage when the actors have gone home, and she sweeps the stage and cleans up after them. So that is actually me now. But if you go to the Norwegian media, you will have to look hard and long to find someone more demonized than me, because I've been visible within the media for the last years as very critical voice of dissent.
How did that, tell us just how that happened, how that occurred, and why they, because usually what happens, at least in Sweden and some of the other countries here, they just do not kind of touch those issues at all. They just avoid it altogether. Were you a media, kind of in the media limelight before you kind of started on your little awakening journey, if we can call it that?
Absolutely. I was on my awakening journey. And then it was during the swine flu period that I was kind of launched onto the national stage, but it is, as you say, we had to ambush the media and use strategies to come onto the national media actually to be heard at all. So once you are heard, special things happen to you, but that's kind of how it started. So during the swine flu media, some of us became very visible, and then it has escalated from there, and now we have a few voices or a few people that are commonly known, nationally more or less, or people recognize our names and they know that we actually have the position of dissenters or nonconformists.
Yeah.
And Michael is absolutely one of them.
Very good. Now, I wanted to ask you as well, before we get deeper into this then, just a little bit about the media environment, because obviously we have a personal experience of yours we're going to relate a little bit later, but I think according to the World Happiness Index, I think that's what it's called. It's actually a study being done by the Legatum Institute. It's a globalist think tank, pretty much. One of the spearheading gentlemen there is Jeffrey Gedmin from the Aspen Institute and Council on Foreign Relations and some of the other interesting neocon connections that he has. And he has released his index, and the Legatum Institute, continuously put Norway on the number one spot there. And there are a couple of parameters for this. For example, the economic situation, there is the so-called the happiness question, but also freedom of the press and freedom of expression and freedom of speech and everything else. And if the situation is same as it is in Sweden, then we certainly do not have a free press. We have a state-subsidized press, one that do not, you know, bite the hand that feeds it, and the critique is very, very nominal. So an extension to this is, of course, that when this indexing think tank comes along to ask people in Norway, for example, about questions like, how corrupt do you perceive your politicians or your political system to be? Usually that score is pretty fairly low, because people are not aware of it, because an indication of this is that the press have to first of all talk about these issues so that people are aware of how corrupt it is. That's the situation I feel in Sweden. Would you say that it's very similar in Norway?
Yes, absolutely. And that is what we will be talking about basically, because projected to us, you'll see that there is the image that we live in the best country in the world and that our people is the happiest on the planet. And then Occasionally you have polls and you have statistics that try to embed these facts, facts into our minds so we will never forget. So if you ask any Norwegian, they have some kind of automatized repeat button when they and they will tell you just how wonderful our country is. But it's a default answer,
right? You get a default answer from the person you're talking with.
Exactly, because the image projected to us, it's so easy to feel the logical dissonance and to feel that something is not quite right, and that's what we'll be touching upon. And this is very painful, actually, for the Norwegian people. And what we experience these days is the pains of waking up, and many people right now see their illusions crumbling, which is very painful. But before getting more into that, if it's all right by you, I just wanted to clarify a little more about my position, or actually
sure.
What I wanted most of all was possibly to conclude right away, just to ensure that the conclusion doesn't get lost in the details, because as it is, we have a very clear image of what is wrong with our countries. And I would for one, I think possibly Mike too, be able to describe it quite precisely.
Mm-hmm.
So what I feel, or what I actually know, is that we, the people in the Scandinavian countries, we have been subjected to a scam that runs so deep that it's very hard to grasp. So what we see is that George Orwell's Animal Farm has been created within a format that could be called the welfare state.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's exactly how it is. And then the objective, the real objective, has been to capitalize to the max on the human resource. And at the same time, all kinds of techniques of social engineering are being actively employed. So each time we show nonconformist behavior, they come along with with some instrument to prod us and to get us back in line.
Yeah.
So actually, what we think of as the government, because we think we have the government and that we are a sovereign nation state, but my findings is that these governments are actually nothing more than just platforms. And the purpose is to ease the corporatization of everything that can be sold. So our names, our birth certificates, our DNA, our signatures, everything can be sold. And as I said, this is the purpose of government. And the government is in itself a corporation with owners.
Yeah. Well, sorry to interrupt, but I have to chime in. There's something that I've seen as well, that the lingo, the language of that comes with the welfare state has been a scam to begin with. I mean, we see nothing for it practically, and it's all, I mean, people have to question the services that they get in return for the, you know, alleged services provided by the government. So it's all that. What I've never understood is that people continue to return to it as a safety mechanism because they're scared to a certain extent to be on their own, they're not going to be left on the outside, but that seems to be a kind of a perception within the Nordic states that it's very important. You know, it's all about security and safety, and that the government is there like your mommy and daddy and capture you in case, you know, something happens. But if something happens, it's very easy to slip through the cracks because that system is an illusion there to begin with.
Exactly. And, you know, it's done very cleverly, too, because in Norway and also in Sweden and in Denmark, we have beautiful nature landscapes, and especially in Norway, which is very small and thinly inhabited country. People, they love the nature. So do I. I love my country, and we have a feeling of closeness to nature. So what the state has done, or what has been done, has been kind of to create an association between everything we love and the state.
Yeah.
Like creating neuronal pathways that when we think of the state, we automatically think of everything we love, like the nature. So you know, when someone comes along to criticize the state, people, they feel almost grief because it's as if they are losing everything.
Oh, it's a personal attack, you know?
Yes, it is. So it is, as you say, there is no way of, for most people, they cannot even begin to conceive how life would be without the state, because we have been born into the social contract, indoctrinated quite heavily since we were small.
Yeah.
We just haven't known that it's been indoctrination. We have thought that we've had a free country and that the things we learn in school are accurate and represent reality in a very good way, but actually it's been indoctrination. And to some people begin to realize this, but it's painful.
Well, indeed. And Mike, let us know if you want to chime in or have anything to add to this as well. Feel free to just jump into the discussion, okay?
Well, I do agree very much with the idea of the animal farm. And Norwegian socialization is the absolute best well-kept animal farm in this district.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a political laboratory. It's been very easy because of, I think, the trust in all. There's a couple of professors in Sweden as well, specifically a guy called Lars Trägård, who they wheel out every time they're talk about anything that's Swedish. For example, we had that piece, I don't know if you guys read that, in The Guardian by Michael Booth, who basically attacked the Scandinavian countries and the model. And, I mean, I was very, to the first initial extent, I was glad to see that, but on the second side of it, I was also disappointed to see that the critique was kind of misappropriated, was directed in the wrong, places to a certain extent. But nonetheless, they wheeled out Lars Trägård, who detailed this afterwards in The Guardian, and basically defending the system and saying that, no, it's not a totalitarian state. This is all voluntary. People are agreeing to it. But my point has always been that the social, environment that exists here, the social engineering, partitioned with the education system, the fact that at least in Sweden, homeschooling has been banned, it's incredibly homogenized, and this kind of image is being built of how you are supposed to be. And if you break that mold, if you fall out on the outside of that, you really feel how narrow it is very quickly, and also that it is totalitarian in nature,
Not only that, but it describes mediocrity.
Yes.
The thing is simply mediocrity. And if you're an extremist, that also means you're bad, when it also can mean you're extraordinary.
Exactly. It works both ways. You have crab mentality, or basically no one can kind of escape or do something different and come out of that. Go ahead, Inga.
Yeah, so actually, if you read, it's interesting what you say, because my impression is that when you read the works of people like Bertrand Russell and Aldous Huxley, The Brave New World and George Orwell also, they have a futuristic vision of what the scientifically created society would be. And I think that what you see in the Scandinavian countries is exactly this. So you see all the mechanisms in place for eroding family life, and how the woman and everyone is asked to identify with serving the state as the maximal goal in life, actually.
That's right.
And the state will care for your children. So what I think is that the Scandinavian countries must have been consciously chosen to see what can be created in terms of turning us into submissive slaves. And what is also true is that one of the mechanisms that they use is to choose half or to have a huge state administration so that half of the people can work for the state and their job will be to control the rest.
Exactly.
So we keep each other in place.
And it's very good, very well put. It's a kind of a self-policing. It's not a police state as you would think of it, because the police, the existence for the militarized police, or the full-on guards out there with tasers and acoustic weaponry and everything, that's not needed, because the population police each other, right? It's a perfect efficient system in that way. But it's very important what you bring up, and that dependency on the state as well. I think in Denmark, I think that over 50%. Well, I know that the state is the largest employer, but the one thing that usually people miss as well is that one of the reasons for the success economically, and we don't have to look at Norway's oil resources as of yet, but the fact is that it has been built on at least about 100 years of free market before the ideas of Folkhemmet, the socialist kind of environment came into place. And that's why, for example, we saw a crash in Sweden in, back in the 90s, because it was basically, it managed to perpetuate itself just for so long before it actually crashed. And I think that one of the reasons why Norway has survived is because of the oil funds and can still do the same behavior, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. That's exactly what is happening. But you know, our countries are very confusing because, yeah, they can still lean on the relative riches or the relative welfare that they are able to muster. But the thing is that we feel, or what we see, is a very subtle form of totalitarianism, because there is a stark contrast between the facade and the actual things the government do. So it's very confusing. It's like dealing with Hannibal Lecter, really. It's as if you have smooth operations on the surface, and then you see that Norway promotes itself as the peace negotiating and peacekeeping country, the kind of on top in the hierarchy of countries with very noble intentions. And so we are very big on promoting ourselves as the most humanitarian country in the world, and the nicest people. And we are also taught regularly that we are a nation of good people and we are actually best in the world at many things.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there is a darker side, because it's also reflected in the numbers, and I'll get back to some of the numbers. But you will see that we engage very heavily in military operations in countries where we really have no business. And the basis for our participation in Libya and such is based on the thinnest public discourse you would ever see. And you hardly need any argument at all, because people are used to thinking that our government is good and it has noble intentions.
Yeah.
So it's all right. They can just go to war. Doesn't matter. So even if the people realize that, okay, 1 million people was killed in Iraq due to our interventions, and we spent billions and billions on aircrafts bombing Libya, there is no connection made in the mind that creates crack in your perception of what the state is.
Yeah.
So you see, the public pension fund, that we have very good feelings for it, because we think that this is our national pride and our saving vest. And then when you see where they invest the public pension fund, it's into the most nefarious corporation you could ever think of. And so this fund, this pension fund that is referred to all the time and that is supposed to support us into the future, is kind of leaving a trail of unimaginable brutality behind and destruction. So, and also among people, they will feel that the state more and more and more comes down with an iron fist.
Yeah.
And using brutal, stupid force in a way that we haven't seen before, because this has been an innocent country. So we can see that that the public discourse is hardening and that the grip is tightening, and which is also why many more people are awakening, because the state is becoming more and more brutal in an open way, actually.
Which is a good thing, you know, ultimately. Let me just ask you quickly before we leave the government pension fund, because this is it's actually the petroleum fund of Norway, correct? It's the same one, right?
Yes, that's the one. And it's now called the pension fund because it has a good
name, exactly,
yeah.
Because now they can't even associate, like, you know, oil has, petroleum has obviously been demonized now around the world to all environmentalists and everything else.
Yeah.
So you can't mention anything about that, right? You can't face reality, the fact that, you know, yes, we use petroleum, people, just get over it, or, you know, let's bring on a new energy device to the market here. But nonetheless, surplus oil money then goes into this one. It's holding, I believe, 1% of global equity markets, this fund, which is huge. I mean, it's the largest stock owner in Europe. And this began, I think, Norway discovered, or I discovered oil a little bit earlier, but it started really around late 60s, 69, 70s. That's when this began. And one of my questions has always been, if this is such an incredible huge fund, why does Norway not pay off its debt, for example? Norway still has about 30% of GDP debt, and this means that this is something they could actually sort out with this fund and actually make sure that all the money that's brought in is something that's from scratch. They don't owe, you know, the IMF or anything, you know, anything. But they don't do that. And people also have a perception that the sovereign wealth fund or the government pension fund is going to be distributed among Norwegians. You all have a piece of it, right? You all are going to be rich someday. You're going to get a handout from the government. This is never going to happen, right?
No, it's never going to happen. And there is some kind of rule, an action rule, they call it, that permits them to use, I think it's 4% of the income of the pension fund each year on the population. So what's obvious to most people, because we have this notion of us being the richest country in the world, but when you look to healthcare and when you look to public schooling and such, you will see that what happens to all the money, where do they go? Because you cannot find them. You cannot see the traces of this distribution of wealth actually among the people. You can't see that the infrastructure is getting better. What you see is the contrary, that everything is deteriorating. So what I think about the public fund is more that it is used as an investment platform for corporate forces. And we are told that we have an annual return of, I think it's like 13% of the investments we make every year. And 13% is very little. If you are into investing in the stock market, and especially into the type of corporations that the public investment fund invests into, then you would expect a much larger return. So my impression is that this is kind of a pool of money and a platform for investment that is one example of many of the transfer of wealth from the grassroots and to the oligarchical forces in Europe. My impression is that this is what we see. We see a looting of the people. We see that we lose everything, and that's the tendency. We're told that we are a rich country, but this is actually just an illusion, because where is the money? We don't see the money.
Well, exactly. I wonder if it's a slush fund. I mean, ultimately, it's Norges Bank Investment Management that actually controls the fund, the Norwegian Central Bank in this case. You know, who's on the board there? Where does this actually go? People are way too naive in the Scandinavian countries and think that there's nothing, there's no corruption going on. There's not people who line their own pockets. I mean, the fact is that the corruption is so brilliantly veiled in obscurity by the government that that's also why you don't hear a lot of loud voices out there in Scandinavian countries speaking up and talking about this. And even if they were speaking up, there wouldn't be a media environment for them to speak up in. So the rest of the world has an opinion that, oh my God, it's got to be great, right? It's something, they're doing something right, because I don't hear any critique.
The Norwegian bank and the oil department are actually registered on the New York Stock Exchange.
Yes.
So these are corporative essences. They don't have anything to do with government.
Yeah.
And when we spoke about the purpose of government as a platform for corporatization of everything that can be sold, actually, I think that might be a central point, because the point seems to be, how can we make the most, how can we capitalize the most on the resources that are available to us? So what's happening is that in the same way as property can be sold, countries can also be sold, and the assets within it. And the assets within it is actually you and me and our productive capacity. So what I think is that Norway is owned by someone, which is why we see the looting of the country, right?
Yeah.
So in order for the government to obtain new loans, because it's ridiculous, actually, that Norway has a foreign loan, or that they have loans. But that's how it works, how the scam works, actually, when you understand the scam and the deeper structures of the scam. So To be able to obtain new loans, the government can lean anything. And that's what politics these days is actually about. And I think that I heard that in Sweden you had the case of Öresundsbron.
Mm-hmm.
The bridge of Öresund was leaned to obtain a 120 billion loan, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah.
Yes, but there has been very little in the media about that. So what we see is that the apex of the financial industry, the banks and such, they are actually trading in all kinds of security that can be sold and rehypothecated and rolled over until it all blows up in our faces. What you can see around us is that among our European brothers and sisters, it has already blown up in their faces, right? And you can see that from the demonstrations in Spain, for instance, and there is no coverage of this in our media. So what we actually see is, I think, in our times, which is why it's so important for us to speak out, and which is why Mike and me do the work we do, is that we see a very hasty transfer of wealth from the grassroots. And so to sum it up, this is what you see. You see the politics about these days seem to be about getting the signature, getting someone to sign so that you can have a transfer of wealth into the hands of an oligarchy that is basically the banks, actually, or the very few corporations that control the world. And this is, it's happening so quickly. And the pension fund is among, or is also used as such an instrument. But what we see is that all of our national resources are privatized and sold. The water is becoming privatized. The electricity has been, which is kind of our national gold. So everything that we used to think were sovereign values, everything can be now securitized, sold on the open market. And this is this looting of our countries, which will be leaving us without much, which will be actually sending us back into poverty, and this is happening in Europe. This is the reason for us now reacting and asking the people please to wake up and please to realize, for one, what is going on, and secondly, what you are consenting to, because this can only happen through your consent. So if you wake up and see through this game, then that's a very good vantage point for taking our powers back and our future back.
Let me just comment on that too, because just what you mentioned is absolutely true, and about the selling of the private or the public assets rather. And then another fallacy on top of that is that people mistake that for being free market or so-called capitalism. When, for example, we had a guest on who actually was one of the persons that visited the Bank of International Settlements, those meetings in Basel, Joan Vion. We still have that in the archives for people. But she brought this up and talked about what's known as public-private partnership, PPP. This is the selling of public assets. And then you have, of course, a few people from within government who, for example, goes onto the board on a company that actually managed to get the contract to purchase these assets. So you have a very few people controlling it. And the company, though, is still under the management of government. They're still under the restriction and the rules set by government. So there are going to be tariffs and fees there. So it's a win-win situation where government still kind of by proxy controls it. But you have a small amount of privately owned, people privately can own the assets and make money on it. But the government makes money on it as well. So it's this perfect merger of two different systems that seemingly would clash and collage. But the fact is that now they've managed to pull this off with the public-private partnership. So it's not free market and it's nothing to do with that.
No, it's not at all free market in no way. But my impression is even maybe more radical than yours, but I might be wrong. But my impression is definitely that the banks own us and that a scam was pulled where we went bankrupt in the 30s after the general bankruptcy in 29, and were forced into agreements with the banks. And when we then became illiquid after that, we became the property of the banks. So what I think is that what we think of as our nations are owned by the banks. They are actually the banks own us and control us, and we can see that also from documentation. It's very easy to see how the European Central Banks through Basel and through the Basel 1, 2, 3 have stranglehold on regulation, and this is absorbed into Norwegian law as passed for Norwegian law, but has nothing to do with Norwegian law at all. But from documentation that we have seen from the World Bank, we can clearly see that the Norwegian Central Bank is an account in the World Bank, and that the World Bank also is owned by the BIS, and that this is the apex of the forces that run us, and to be able to pull this scam, to pull this illusion of freedom while we really are slaves, just in modern format. It's as if they had to create something called the welfare state and something that resembles a sovereign state, and where you have the illusions of real politicians having real power. But when you look to the legislative powers, which are the expression of the people, or supposed to be, in the so-called democratic countries, then you see that they have no power anymore, not at all. So, also gradually, the sovereign powers have been signed off, and now the people, when they go to the election polls, and they choose between the array of parties that they think will make change politically, what they don't know really is that there is no representation any longer within the government, and the constitution is by no means upheld.
Yeah.
And they really don't realize how much of our sovereignty has been signed off.
Yeah. And you guys in Norway are still not part of the European Union, but you have tons of economic agreements with them, which still kind of make you really under the thumb of the European Union anyway. So it's another illusion, basically.
Yes, because, you know, if you count the laws, because the sole purpose of the parliament is to legislate, to give laws. And then you actually expect that the laws that come to us, to the people, and are filtrated down through the system, come from the parliament. But then, if you go to the database where you can, it's something called law of data, then you can actually count the laws and compare the laws and see how many laws were there before the European Union and how many laws are there now and how many laws have come from the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you count the laws, you actually see that I would say 95% of all of our legislation comes from the European Union.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Norway is the country that is most loyal to the European Union, and 99.7 of the directives, which are called laws, that we get from the European Union are passed as law or as directives.
Hmm. Oh.
Statutes. So I think that but this is kind of, you see, the image promoted to us of who we are, it's as you say, we are told that we are the most proper people, good in hygiene, good in keeping the rules, good in being, good in conforming, and the purpose of conforming is that we show solidarity towards one another. So we have these standards of conduct that make us into very obedient slaves, actually, and actually make us proud when we can say that, well, we are conforming very nicely to the standards presented by the EU and such.
Yeah.
So,
well, this is positive reinforcement training. You did the same with dogs. Well done, little boy. Here you go. Here's a treat. You know, but well done. It's absolutely the same thing, and it's done on a very, very, base level. But the fact is that this, as well, and to reemphasize that point, this is a successful system that has been put in place when the globalist meeting takes place, and when you know, what's the prime minister over there in Norway again called? What's his name? Stoltenberg, right?
When
he goes to the World Bank meetings and all the other economic meetings around in Europe, and promotes the Nordic model, as this is like, you should start looking at this now, because this, ladies and gentlemen, this is it. We have it. We found it. We know how to control them. You know, the question, of course, is if this is going to be successfully actually applied to other populations. There's a lot that speaks against that. But nonetheless, I think a tweaking, a subtle change and adaptation to other cultures and other nations might be able to be a successful task for them, to actually create that totalitarian state that also Huxley talked about, that people are going to love their servitude, that actually want it, that we need it, you know?
But if you want, because it is also cracking up. We can see that it is cracking up, and I think that was unexpected for our governing forces. So if you want to, maybe we could touch a little upon the means of control that the state actually uses to keep us in line.
Yeah, certainly.
Because it's very interesting, and it's so fascinating that people don't see through this the techniques, because you can very well see that controls of or techniques of mind control and social engineering techniques are being used on you. So maybe we can begin a little with the media, because the media is the primary tool used to keep us in check in shocking ways, very often actually. So what we see is that in order to keep us in place, they need to have the media, the mediatic tools to kind of fixate a worldview and also make opposition impossible, because if you oppose, then you are hang out dry in front of the whole nation. So what they need is very narrow worldview that can easily be controlled.
And you felt this, Sergeant Trapper, you felt this firsthand, because you've been appointed to be that kind of person in certain settings, right? When you talk negatively about the vaccinations, for example, or anything else, where you basically break the mold of the established view in any issue, really, and you have been for a little bit kind of the go-to person. So you've experienced that firsthand of how it is to be put on the outside and basically ridiculed on that level, correct?
Very much. So what they do primarily is, when you get out offline and want to take the conversation or discourse into another direction, is that they start tagging you and name-calling you, kind of based on advanced tools for trauma-based mind control. So when you have a trauma that is deeply embedded in the minds of the people, in their psyche, such as the Holocaust or the Norwegian killings at Utøya in 2011, When you actually hint to these events and associate them to your name, then people are immediately repulsed. So if you speak against the government, you will immediately be called an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Or on the other hand, they will be hinting that, okay, so maybe you are supporting Anders Behring Breivik.
Yeah, I know. That's funny.
And checkmate, and then you're just expelled from the game.
Right.
And you are placed under the radar of the national NSA and registered on their list as promoting hatred.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Even if what you really promoted. So what I am promoting and all the people like me is the opposite. We promote no wars, no killings, no GMOs, no pesticides. So what the government do is actually just to play us like fiddles through the emotional programming instilled in us since we were children. But it's interesting to see, because you touched briefly upon that, and the tools that they use is the state use some agencies to promote the scientific worldview, such as the Human Ethical Society, for instance. And they also pay a wide range of internet trolls and bloggers, right?
Sure.
And so these so-called humanist organizations are very much related to the more militant arms of the skeptic society. And so what we see is that they actually place university professors in strategic positions, and then they can just pretend to represent the expertise and will always be called upon. If the media needs an opinion from someone, they will always call upon these. So they have a list of people that they always call, right?
Oh, definitely. We say exactly.
And they can be relied upon because they will kind of instill the established consensus within the people, and they will never speak wrong word.
Well, that's another culture. We've talked about that before in the program on our series that we've done on Sweden specifically. But this, again, they very much incorporate the whole, all of the Nordic countries, really. But just this idea of the collective identification within each individual. I would argue that there isn't actually such a thing as an individual within the Nordic model or within the Scandinavian society at large. But nonetheless, there's a way that you always seek external verification for something. If something mm-hmm. happens, you know, you wait for the expert to come on the TV and tell you what to think about, you know, issue A or B. And it's very much a non-engaging kind of process that people are involved in, where they basically they wait for the authority, the external authority, to tell them either what to do or how to react or what to think about something. Mm-hmm. And it's very easily absorbed, and there's no thinking or no processing further of that. I'm not really sure yet how they've managed to create that kind of person, but it seems to be pretty much like a 99% of the population, maybe even more, are like that. And then there are a few people like yourselves who see through this and have managed to kind of speak up in some manner against that, you know?
Yeah, but I can never really understand how it's possible for the people not to see these connections, because we have some incidents such as the swine flu outbreak, and this incident alone would be enough to tear the paradigm wide open if the people could realize what really happened. Because, you know, when the swine flu broke out, the coverage in the Norwegian media was unanimously urging you to take the vaccine. And there was not even one medical doctor who came to voice a dissent. And everywhere you'd find little posters in the schools and in the government agency urging you to take the vaccine. And so when we translated the investigation of Jane Burgermeister, it was blatantly obvious that a scam was being forced upon us. And we had access to all kinds of scientific reports, readily available to anyone, so and telling you quite clearly of the dangers of narcolepsy. So what we did was we formed an action group, and we went on to national television, and we told the people, this is going to happen. If you take this vaccine, you might have narcolepsy, because it has happened before in the States in 76, and it's also a known danger of squalene, one of the adjuvants of the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So we, the lay people, normal people from the street, we knew all of this, and we could refer to scientific reports. And the state authorized panel of experts, they said, no, the vaccine is absolutely safe, and they knew nothing of this. So what happened was exactly as we predicted, that number of children now suffer, and they have their lives ruined from this, from the narcolepsy. So the one conclusion that you have to draw is that we do have a government who is willing to inflict suffering and pain upon the people on purpose to serve the corporate masters. And there is no other conclusion to be drawn. So I just can't see how can people live with these conclusions and still think everything is okay?
Well, I think it is a very deep, not only subconscious identification with authority, but just something they even consciously know, that if you begin to, if you have lived your life where you have used the state, to the government authority as the crutches to your own life, if you are to remove those, if you are to expose those for the lies that they are, the fact that they don't have your best interest at heart, they don't give a shit about you. If you come to that realization, that would mean that the way that you've lived your life and the way you supported yourself for all that time is going to crumble underneath you, and you are literally not going to be able to stand on your own feet or your own legs because of that. You won't be able to carry your own weight. So it is that dependency, I think, that is so dangerous. And again, I think that that's why, from a psychological point of view, they have pushed the idea of security and safety, and this is going to be something that's external to you. It's not going to be that you are the own master of your own life. You rule yourself, you judge yourself, you make your own decisions, but it's always completely external, and therefore they defend the state because they are, in fact, the state.
Exactly. So it's, sometimes I think that it's as if the population is suffering from the Stockholm syndrome, where you actually love your abuser, because so many people are so scared of waking up, because they might even perceive that there is a contrast between what we are told and what really is. So it's so scary for them to wake up, and what they often say to me, they kind of cling to the illusions that at least things are better in Norway than in the rest of the world. So they tell me, would you rather live in Somalia or some place like that? And then they are happy. So they're happy with the minimum. But one very confusing point is that the politicians that we see, the visible ones, they are nice people, and we can readily identify with them. And we also can see that the king, he is going for walks in the forest, and he's a nice person. And then it's so subtle. The scam is so subtle, because you kind of sense that these can't be the people in charge, which they aren't, basically.
Exactly.
So the puppet masters that actually pull the threads of the marionettes, we don't see them.
That's right.
What we see is the external reality. So we can't dig any deeper than what we see on the surface, and probably that's because we see that the prime minister is a very nice person. She really is. And so it's easy to feel trust.
Erna Solberg is now the prime minister in Norway.
Oh, so you guys have a new one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Was there a recent election then?
Stoltenberg, Worker Party, lost the election to the right-wing party.
And how right-wing is that right-wing party? Because if it is, as it is in Sweden, then the moderates, they're the new working party. They're just the same as the social democrats. Is it the same in Norway?
Exactly.
Well, yes, I think so.
It's exactly the same.
It's a fraud. I mean, they're not conservative. Yeah. There isn't any conservative party in the Nordic countries.
And now the ex-prime minister from Norway, Stoltenberg, is the secretary for NATO.
Ah, okay, so he took over the role of the previous Dane. What was his name again? He was the head of NATO for a while there.
It's a swing door policy.
Interesting. It's a lot of Northerners that then have become the heads of NATO. That's very, very interesting, of course, because we're promoting peace and neutrality, right? And Sweden is the biggest munitions manufacturing per capita in the world, so there you have that. But
I thought that was us. So that's you.
I think Norway is gaining on Sweden there.
On weapons manufacturing?
Yeah.
Oh,
really?
Yes. The Baltic make are hyper exclusive.
Ah, interesting. Okay, yeah, maybe you are. The latest statistics I read, Sweden were still pretty much number one, but that was a couple of years ago, so maybe that has changed now. That's interesting.
I also do believe that we make DU ammunition in Norway.
Depleted uranium?
Yes.
Well, that would be interesting. Are you guys shipping that in from somewhere, or are you using the nuclear waste?
I used to be an advertising photographer. I had them as my client once. They do advanced stuff. And I've heard from people in the military that have family working there that say, yes, they do produce DU ammunition.
Wow. All right. Well, that's interesting. Now, guys, I think we should take a little short break here in a while. We want to give out some details and stuff like that before we do that, though. But I also just want to say that I think that Norwegians, Swedes, Danes, Finns, Icelanders, you name it, need to find the pulse of their ancestors again and find some heroism, some brave tendencies, and learn to identify what it really used to be as part of these countries, you know. And and step away from this idea that there's a identification with the state and that the state rules over you as a subject to it. And I think it's a really important time to do that, because otherwise, I mean, this is going to be completely lost. The control is so adamant at this stage. But you said, no, nonetheless, Ingunn, you said that very eloquently, that as the iron fist becomes more obvious, as the control grip gets tighter, there are more and more people that are beginning to wake up from that. So that is something that we do have to work in our advantage, if you will.
Absolutely. And I think that what makes this possible is the growing spirituality that you can see, and the longing to explore our backgrounds. It could be within the Viking mythology, but also generally you see the growing spirituality. And as for me, it's the universe that has helped me through this.
Yeah, very good. Now, yeah, let's give out some details, guys. Ingunn, obviously, you set up a website. You have, I don't know how long you've been running it, but please give us the URL for that so people know where to go. Is that primarily Norwegian, or is it some English writing you have there as well?
So sorry, but it's just in Norwegian as it is, but we will be translating it as soon as we can. But for the record, it's sigurdsdatter.com.
Oh boy, do you want to spell that for, or should I just link that up for people who want to find that?
it's my last name, actually, .com.
Yeah. Okay, so it's SIGURDSDATTER.com. Okay, we'll have that up, Sigurd. Mike, do you have a website that you want to give out?
No website. The only thing I have is Blog Talk Radio, which is called Michael's Roundtable Talk. That has a Facebook page.
We are talking with Ingunn Sigurdsdatter about Norway, the happiest place in the world, and of course breaking down the myth that Norway is one of the best countries to live in the world. One conclusion, though, of this is that if Norway is the best place in the world, then we are in deep trouble, and we've not managed to achieve much. In fact, it would be a sign that the prison planet is well underway, and that conformity and control is the main objective, and that's kind of some of the things we'll talk about here in the second hour as well, as we get deeper into the experiment, the political laboratory that has been the Nordic countries and Scandinavia. But Ingunn, I wanted to ask you more about what actually happened to you. We haven't gotten into this yet. You know, the cops came knocking on your door. I mean, this is something, as you've been starting to feel now as a quote-unquote outsider, I guess, to a certain extent, of how, you know, easy it is for you to navigate in Norwegian society now, when you've been, you know, kind of try to set yourself outside of it, basically, because, you know, as we've been talking about before, Norwegian and Swedish, Danish society, Finnic and Icelandic too, to a certain extent, it's all about conformity. And if you bump up against those edges of the playpen of the country, you feel pretty darn quick how limited we are, really. So tell us what happened to you, and give us that story, Ingunn.
Yeah, I will. And I'll also give you a little background on why I became sovereign. But before that, I'll tell you the actual story and what led up to it. Because what I did was that I turned in my citizenship. And I didn't have to do it with bravado or with commotion, but I actually did. So technically, it would have been enough just to tell the government or the administration that there had been a mistake, since they seemed to assume that there existed some contract between us. But what I wanted to do was, with my example, to inspire other people actually to try to contribute to reducing the crimes committed by the state and creating awareness around these matters. So what I did was, I went to the mayor's office and I brought my passport. And I called the newspapers before, because this is the nature of the media, that they are also vain and they like good stories. So I knew that this would probably be irresistible for them to accompany me to the mayor's office and see me turning in my passport. So that's what I did. And this story actually became the most read story of the year of this newspaper. And then when I made such a statement on the front pages, the local authorities immediately had to come and make a counter statement the next day, claiming that everyone living on Norwegian soil had to conform to Norwegian law, and that it would be impossible actually to recede from the state. And then I made a counter reply, also in the newspaper on the whole page, saying that it wasn't really relevant to me what the government's response was, because it was exactly their jurisdiction that I challenged and I didn't believe in.
What paper was that, by the way, and how come they how come they agreed to do the, you know, give you such space there?
Exactly, because this was a local newspaper. It was the county newspaper, or the called Telemark Arbeiderblad.
Right.
Eller Telemarks Avisa. But you know, so when you go to the local level, even if the story comes out in a small newspaper, when the story has transcendence, it's immediately picked up by everyone. So very quickly it had been shared many thousand times on Facebook and such. So even a small newspaper can be used as a channel to bring forth this information. And had they known the criticism that they would get afterwards, they would probably not have, or they would have thought twice, most likely. But what I've come to understand is that the media is kind of a double-edged sword, because you can also use it to your advantage, because the media has an interest in publishing things that everyone would like to read. They are like prostitutes in that sense.
They're all for the numbers.
Yeah. So if you can arouse their interest in some way, sometimes they will swallow the bait, and so they did. The role that I carved for myself was that of guinea pig. Which means that all of a sudden everybody knew what I'd done, and all eyes were on me, which was what I wanted. Because to put yourself up against the government is actually dangerous. So I knew it. I had to be in the middle of the bullseye, because that's where you are the most protected. For me, I was very curious to see how the government would react after that, because what I did was very intimidating for them. And so far, there has just been one direct encounter, and what happened there was what you actually saw, and that's how you found me.
The video when who was filming that, by the way?
That was a friend, and by the grace of the universe, he was with me that day.
Right. Yeah.
I was so lucky. The government has done various things to harass me, but none of them as directly as on this day. So. What happened was that, just to make a living, I now do other things than I used to do before. So I give clairvoyant readings, and I wash houses, and I do spring rolls for sale. So then one day, someone called me from the regional Mattilsynet, that it's called, which is the National Food and Drug Authority, the FDA. And they told me that they'd heard that I was producing spring rolls. And the way that they knew was by means of anonymous informers, because that's how it works.
Someone was snitching on you, huh?
Snitching on me. Which is great. Nice. It was kind of cute, because I'm snitching on myself every day.
Right.
Because what I do is actually to always publish very openly my intentions and the things I do. Mm-hmm. So then someone snitched on them, saying that she's producing spring rolls and she isn't paying taxes. Maybe you should look into that. So they They called me and they said, "We hear you are producing spring rolls." And I said, "Yes, I do. And they are very good also. Would you like to order?" and then, they told me that, or I told them that we need to continue this conversation by mail, because it's very important always to have written a record of the things that take place as a protection. So they mailed me and they said, in very kind way, that, well, you know, we can help you actually to establish a more secure production, and we can give you some good advice on how to produce these spring rolls. And then I told them that, oh, thank you, that was a very kind offer, but I declined because I already know these things. So thank you, but no thank you. And then they mailed me back a little more condescending this time, saying that, okay, but then probably also, you know, that it's your duty to register your enterprise. Then I said that, okay, but actually your jurisdiction doesn't apply to me, because I'm not any longer a part of the state. So then they fell silent for some time. And one day I woke up in the morning, and early in the morning, and then at my door were two ladies smiling, saying, hello, we are from the FDA. Can we come to inspect your kitchen?
That's fine.
And I said, no, no, sorry, you cannot. Bye-bye.
So it was all good good vibes, no kind of anger in there. Yeah, it's funny because it's like, this is what I've been trying to describe to people as well, that it's very much, it's a tyranny, but it comes in a velvet glove. It's a very helpful. We're not there to hurt you. We just want to help you. Unless, of course, you continue to, resist what they want to impose on you, then you'll feel a strong force after some time. But yeah, do go on.
Exactly. And just another point, because as a sovereign, in the old days, and as a general rule, you always lost your legal standing if you were in dishonor or if you didn't treat other people honorably. So to me, it's kind of a point always to be honorable, to treat other people honorably. So I see that very many in the national discourse, in the public discourse, they are very angry with the government, so they become abusive. But we had very nice conversation. And then I said, ciao, ciao. And after 1 week or so, they came back in the morning, once again, then with a policeman. And luckily enough, on this day, I had a friend visiting, so I went in to get him, to ask him to film what went on. So we came to the door, and I said that, hello, we'll be filming this. And the police officer said, no, absolutely not. And I said, oh, yes. And he said, no, that's not going to happen. And my friend said, you know, this is actually private territorium, so on what grounds can or he was actually more strict, so he said, that's not your choice, this
right.
is private property.
So
the police officer quite visibly felt embarrassed and insecure.
He tried to call you out, right? Like, step outside of your own property kind of thing, so we can actually grab you.
He came back to me and he spoke in very authoritarian, very deep voice, saying, okay, so step outside with me. And my friend said, and who are you?
Yeah.
And he scouted his police sign and said, I'm the local police. So I just told him, so on what legal basis do you ask me to come with me?
Well, you're the known spring roll terrorists, haven't you heard? Yeah.
So actually, he tried four times to call me out. And, you know, he was very insecure, but he kind of took on the Dirty Harry attitude and tried to intimidate me with the use of authority in the traditional sense. And I just kept standing. And then they actually had to leave while we were filming all of it. And since then, they haven't come back. But on the next day, the local newspaper came and also the local media. And then we were all on television. And they told me that, well, someone has apparently fallen ill from eating your spring rolls.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, but you know, the authorities are actually known to fabricate evidence, and they do it all the time.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So they also said on the newspaper, on the television, because the reporter asked, "What will you do next? Will you apply the use of force?" And they said, "Oh no, by no means. We just want dialogue." So when I was on TV the same night, I actually told them that you are very welcome to visit me in my home to enter into dialogue with me. I will not enter under your jurisdiction. So it's not about legal issues, but in a friendly way, we can come together and we can have a conversation. So then I didn't hear anything else. And they mailed me saying that, no, thank you, but we'll call you to come to visit at our office because we would like to inform you of your legal rights. And then I just mailed them saying that, sorry, actually your jurisdiction doesn't apply.
Right.
So far that was the end of it.
And so how long ago is that, since we're speaking now here on the 10th of April, how long ago is this?
Well, the last conversation or the last contact we had was yesterday. Yes, so they sent me the evidence that they had got from the informers who claimed that someone had fallen ill. So they actually had two pieces of evidence, and one of them didn't carry a date, no names, nothing. Just a simple note saying that someone has fallen ill, probably over your spring rolls. And that was it. And the other one said that the other one had a date and was actually a genuine informer's note. So it said that, well, this person is producing spring rolls and not paying taxes. And this is the evidence. And then they had screenshot some of my comments from Facebook. And yeah, so that's how far we got.
Oh, boy. Wow. So, they're trying to obviously intimidate you to get you to bow down. So, what do you think their next step is? Are you afraid of this? Because obviously, as we've seen in the past, if it goes far enough, they don't only knock on your door, they break down the door and just come and grab you. Are you afraid of that?
I'm not afraid actually, because in my case, the decisions I've taken in my life has come parallel with also a spiritual life or realizations on an inner level, and I feel that I'm protected actually, and I really am not afraid because I've been through so many processes to shred all of my belief systems and all of my inner blockings. So what I feel is actually trust and bliss, and I feel very happy. And what I irradiate to the people is calm and happiness and friendliness, I think. So that's a very potent weapon, actually. It's some kind of very silent revolution, very peaceful, very friendly revolution. And there is no way that they can counteract this, because as long as I remain in honor with the words that I choose and with my actions, and as long as I'm heard and visible, that's actually very hard to do something about. So it's kind of a standing that I've chosen for myself consciously.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also doing some legal measures, like establishing a people's jury. And the purpose of it is simply to put the government on the spot, asking them where they derive their authority from, because that's the one question that they cannot stand to be, or they can't bear being asked this question, because it's so compromising for them.
It'll be a self-referencing reference, pretty much. They go back to some kind of legal paragraph or something like that, and then say, well, this proves that we have authority. Well, you just wrote that on a piece of paper, So I can write that on a piece of paper and counteract you with the same authority. So it's kind of silly, obviously, when one really gets down to the nitty and gritty of the structure of this kind of level of authority. But one thing I wanted to ask you about that is how did this, when you were attempting then to write yourself out of the system or the authority that they claim that they hold over you, how did that kind of language work in that regard? Did you, was this something you studied beforehand, or was it very much kind of off the cuff, just a simple kind of layman's terms type, you know, of wording on this, or did you use some legalese and, you know, that kind of stuff in it?
In terms of the preliminary process, I had for a long time been very discontent and feeling, of course, that something was wrong. I'd been kind of afraid to open the mailbox, afraid to lag behind on some report to be turned into the government, some bills to be paid. And when I really woke up to how the world is put together and the pieces started to fall into place, it just became more unbearable by the day to have any association whatsoever to the government, because the government promotes cruelty to an enormous extent. We both know that.
Yeah.
And so I felt that I actively contribute to promoting this cruelty when I'm a member or when I'm a citizen. But it was really not until the government started applying pressure on me that I was kind of able to wake up and shake off this trance, because I told you how they tried to put us down through the media with very in very vicious ways, actually. And what they do when you speak up, when you are nonconformist, is that they try to demonize you first. And if it doesn't work, they try to break you economically. So that's what they did to me. What happened to me is that the pressure that they applied to me kind of made my inside burst, and out came a sovereign woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very discontent and not knowing exactly how to react or what to do. And then I just woke up one morning and I knew kind of with all of my body, with every cell within my body, that I could not consent, not even for one more day, to being governed, and especially by such brute force. And in our culture, we haven't been taught to kind of recognize the truth from the lie in a good way. So we aren't used to listening to the body and recognizing the signals. But when I took the decision of becoming sovereign, I could just feel that my whole body responded with joy and with happiness, as if shaking off a veil. And same thing actually happened to me, that my body responded very loudly or very clearly when I changed my name and lost the name that the government owns, my previous name,
mm-hmm.
and took my father's name. So
you went back and took your dad's name?
Yeah, I chose it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, okay.
It was the name that I chose myself, actually, and which isn't the legal person name.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the registered name in any way. So what I did then was that I wrote to the king and to the government, just making a statement, a declaration of sovereignty, stating that I now consider myself a sovereign woman, and I disassociate from any implied contract that has been forced upon me by birth. And, you know, I was very careful to choose my own wording, but not using legalese terms, really, because legalese doesn't apply, not really. It's more about knowing who you are and knowing that you, as a living person, can never be forced to enter into a jurisdiction forced upon you by other human beings. So I stated that I was a living woman, living sovereign woman, not anymore a legal fictitious person, and gave my grounds or gave my reasons for this. And so far, I haven't received any response, and I really don't need also to receive any response, but I did contact the legal department on some occasions. And what I experience is that the government employees are helpless because they cannot possibly engage in this kind of conversation because it's beyond their scope. And also there isn't any language or what's it called? It's not terminology that they are even versed within.
Right.
So they don't know what to say. So they just respond on autopilot, actually always giving an automatized response.
Now, what address did you send this to? I mean, one you said you sent to Harald, right, the king then, and then one to, where did you send the other one?
I sent it to the Department of Justice. And I'm also not the only one, so a number of people have actually done the same thing as I have. And what I see is that even if in the beginning people became actually kind of aggressive towards me and feeling threatened by my actions, now new terminology has been introduced into the public discourse. So many more people have awareness of this, and they have begun to discuss statehood and the basis for the powers of the state, which is amazing. So raised awareness, which actually was my purpose, has happened. But to me, where what I actually felt on a spiritual level, it was that because I went to something called the Princess Martha's Spiritual School. It's actually in Norwegian called the Angel School, but it's really just transmitting esoteric knowledge.
Let me ask you about that. Sorry, was it Princess Mette Louise of Norway? Is that the one?
Yes, okay, she's the one.
Mm. So what's her? I mean, I'm not saying that she's on the same page as you are or whatnot, but obviously there's a tie-in with the royalty there, who has been a representative of the very legal structure that we're basically talking about here. Today, of course, they fulfill quite a different role. I don't know how the position exactly is politically or what kind of enforcement power King Harald has in Norway, but nonetheless, there is a tie in there. So does she, I don't know if you spoke to her directly or anything, but how if so, does she, or is she aware of any of this?
There is actually also a tie between us, and I really think, I genuinely think that she isn't aware of any of this, or that she hasn't given it any consideration whatsoever. And she was very brave in coming forth and promoting this school and this kind of knowledge, because
And it was, sorry to cut you off again, but just to clarify that, she was kind of, it was a little bit more of a new age kind of, in that environment a little bit, right? She had psychic spiritualism and some kind of things like that, right, in her school?
Just to clarify that I'm not in any way on the new age page whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah. And I absolutely apply the spiritual principles in practice into my life, and which is why I'm coming forth as a sovereign person or woman. But I've been one of the critics of the king's role, actually, because it's always diminished to us, and we are told that, oh, but he only has, he doesn't have any formal powers.
Right.
But he is actually, he has signature powers, which is the real power. That's how power is defined.
Yeah.
So he is actually the culprit of, he's the source of the cruelty, really. There's no other way of putting it. And that's confusing to people because And you know, the anatomy of power is not so easy to understand always, because all it takes is signing a piece of paper. And you can be conscious or unconscious of that. That's the king's role, actually.
Right. Yeah. He's the face of it, nonetheless, whether he knows it or likes it or whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So these are probably painful realizations, and I don't think that they have come to grips with this aspect at all. But for me, what I realized is that sovereignty also has a spiritual aspect, and that opening up your energies and your crown chakra depends on not having someone invading your energetic field. So what I felt very strongly was that what the government does is kind of hacking into your energetic field and preventing your crown chakra to function. And when you see the sovereigns, they actually wear a gold crown, and both in a spiritual sense and in a practical sense, that bears a meaning. So the significance of it is actually that they have the energy field open, because they have no ties or no bonds to any other authority, any entity trying to feed off their energy, actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see here if there's anything else we need to discuss there and detail about that in terms of what the effects of this are, not only, of course, in your own life, you think, but also how this will, what the ramifications are with this. I mean, do you sincerely believe that there is any kind of department within the government that actually can process anything of what you've actually sent to them? Or is it just basically that they're trying to determine what they are to do with this in the meantime and trying to figure it out in some way? I guess that's usually why they fall silent, right? And they this is something for them also that could take years, I guess. They just draw out the process, I guess. I don't know.
I think it all depends on us, actually, and our ability to go beyond the level of the government and realizing that we hold the actual powers.
Sure,
And the radical realization that we have actually the right to live without being ruled. Because we're always told that if we haven't rulers, everything will just become chaos and deteriorate.
Sure.
And as I see it, it's the exact opposite, actually. So what governments do is that they bestow upon themselves the powers to commit crimes. Crimes that none of us can do. So governments, they can instigate wars, promote destructions of the environment, and rob the population, and we as individual people would be so heavily punished for these crimes.
Yeah, that's right.
So as I see it, this is what government really is, and as I see it, when we consent to government, to these destructive forces, we abandon our responsibility, which is a very comfortable thing to do. It's very easy to lean against the government and rely on them and feel that you're taken care of. But that, as I see it, that's not what we are doing on this earth.
And that won't last either. Sorry to interrupt again, but it might be comfortable for people for a while. It might be for... and I'm not saying it has been for our generations now necessarily, but the violence that they exuberate is definitely more psychical, if I can put it that way, as opposed to physical. But nonetheless, it might be comfortable for a while. But we know that if human beings don't stand up to the tyranny system around them, they will take more power, they will take more money, they will take more laws and put them over your head, and eventually. If it's not us, it will be, you know, 2-3 generations down the line now that will have to fight the tyranny for us. So our comfort that we were wanted is something that's going to get a reaction further down the line, if you know what I mean.
Yes, exactly. But it also has to do with liability in the legal sense, because if you isolate this issue and look to the legal world, there is a book called The Juristic Person by an author called George F. Dicer. And he actually states very clearly that we are just as much accomplice to the crimes committed by the corporation, which is the government. It's our fault. We are just as much guilty as the government is of the crimes and the brutality carried out by the government. So what we tend to do is to kind of alienate the blame from ourselves. We think that that hasn't got anything to do with us at all. But it actually does. When you are a legal person, as we all are, then we are actually responsible for the things the corporation does. And when you are a natural man or woman, you're just guilty of the crimes that you commit yourself. So this actually runs very deep, and it carries an existential meaning also. This all raises very important questions, and we can't avoid them for long because it's as if the moment has come to address them.
Yeah.
And what we see is that this is also a global tendency. So the work of heroes in many countries is spilling off, or it's rubbing off on me and other people like me in Norway and in the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah, exactly. People agree to it since they continue to fund it. That's the most fundamental basic level to it, that the whole apparatus in itself of government. Of course, we know, most cities and I don't know about municipalities necessarily, but cities are obviously incorporated. Even the very notion, the whole notion of being a corporation is an idea that's been dreamt up by the government. It's a legal framework that they've put into place, you know. But nonetheless, that means to a certain extent that they might be primarily seeking profit as opposed to working as an advantage to the people who fund it. But nonetheless, if people continue to fund it, then it will maintain. And the fact is that since it doesn't generate any money on its own, but just does it as a parasitical entity, which, you know, takes from everyone else and then distributes accordingly to what it thinks it's good. And also on top of it, of course, they take a lot of that money and it goes into the wrong coffers. There's corruption on top of that, so it ends up in the pockets of people who are within politics. But that's really where people need to start standing up to it. And I think there's nowhere in the world as that particular aspect that is so difficult than it is in Scandinavia when it comes to that particular aspect about money and taxes and just the immense power that the state has in these countries.
Yes, that's right. But I also feel that it's a mental shortcut to understand that we are the actual chattel of the government, that they are trading us actually concretely, and our governments are all of them registered on the Washington D.C. Recorder of Deeds. So they are registered corporations. Kingdom of Sweden is easily found.
Yeah, I found it. I saw it.
Yeah, you're right. So the purpose of this, so it's as if registration is kind of the way of trapping us. When we are entered into registration, as we also become practically the property of someone. And this is also why we had to be registered as persons. Or legal persons, then the government actually holds a security interest over us, and can kind of operate under merchant law, which has nothing to do with what we think is the Norwegian law. So the way that they have been trading our birth certificates and our biomass, everything that can be traded, is a point that goes home with a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't want to shift focus too much if there's more, of course, that you want to say about this too, but there's a couple of other aspects that we could discuss, and it has to do with, for example, how There's been a lot of people forcefully admitted into mental hospitals in not only Norway, but in Sweden too. And there's been a long history of eugenics programs running, a lot of experiments. I think one of the first, some of the first experiments on the electronic versions of mind control and implantable chips to affect the brain and whatnot was actually done in Sweden for the longest time. You have aspects yes. like the Lebensborn, for example, the children of German soldiers and Norwegian mothers in Norway. It's been one of the most suppressed groups ever. They were experimented on with LSD. They were raped, etc. There was this horrible history that they've been trying to cover up. So things aren't as nice and dandy, of course. Again, to go back to that initial point we talked about more in the first hour of the yeah. of the external facade that people only see, you know.
But that's a very good point, actually, because when we are told that this is the best country in the world, we are each told that in different ways in the Scandinavian countries, then the numbers give away the reality. So then statistics can be used, can actually be a useful tool of understanding, because we see in Norway that as much as 10,000 people are being admitted into psychiatric wards forcefully every year, which is enormously much in the land or the country of the most happy people. And we also see the how many children are admitted into state care, 52,000 every year. These are horrendous numbers for such a small country. And pieces of our story that hasn't been told to us keep coming up. And it seems that it can't be covered any longer, really, because it surfaces somehow. So stories of mass graves outside the psychiatric hospitals, where they have been doing experiments on the ethnic groups in or the original Lapp people. In Norway, has come to the surface, as you say, enrolling them into experiments with LSD and lobotomy and sterilizing all of them up till 76, actually. So this is quite recent history.
Let me say something about that, too, because I think this is an interesting aspect. And I usually bring this up when it comes to the specific targeting and also persecution of certain peoples, because we seem to neglect the historical aspect, since we're talking about Norway overall, how it gained the authority that it did. It didn't happen overnight. It was not something which was agreed upon by all the rest of the people in the country. So, for example, when we see a situation like this, you might think, oh, my God, everyone in Norway and or Sweden are like ganging up on the Samis altogether, right? So the idea there is that I think the Sami is one of the tribes that still managed to live on, and that's either due to their basic northward location all the way up in Lapland, or it might be possibly because of a later entry into Scandinavia from the more northern tip of Asia. But nonetheless, if you look at, for example, all the landscapes in Sweden and Norway, most of the place names come from the fact that they used to be really powerful tribes, or there was a king that lived there, that had a people there. For example, in Norway, you had the Raumareki, which comes from the Romareki. You had further down in Bohuslän, you had the Vinviljot. I'm kind of butchering some of the names here, but they come from a guy called Jordanius, who wrote about the history of Skanska or Scandinavia. And you have like the Sueti, the Goths, of course, the Heruli, the Grani, the Auga Densi, the Eunixi. I mean, it goes on and on. The Arochi, Raumi from Romsdal, you know, it's like all of these tribes have been under the conquest as the Norwegian government has been formed throughout history and centralized. These tribes, if they haven't been exterminated, they have been absorbed into the bigger, you know, governmental system. And all of these tribes have been targeted. They have been, you know, removed from their own culture and heritage. And today what we see in these countries is very much a boiled down version of the culture that used to be there. You know what I mean? So it's like we can be kind of myopic sometimes when we see it, and it means that everyone who's been living in these countries have been subjected to the same level of tyranny that we can see against someone like the Sami, for example. It's just that this is later in the process. And now, of course, what's worse in the picture for the Sami is that they have a greater scientific and technological apparatus at their disposal. So their experiments and whatnot becomes even more ruthless and brutal. So that's my five cents on that issue.
Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting, actually, because most people, they don't question for a second the state's claim to territory. And they do support the state's claim that they actually own the Norwegian land and that this is theirs.
Yeah.
Theirs to govern as they like. Theirs to exploit the way they like. And as I see it, and which is obviously also the truth, is just that someone came along and made a claim, just like they did in Australia or in all of the world, actually, saying that this is mine, so now my rules apply. And then time passes and it becomes cemented in the minds of the people. But when you mention our history and our spiritual traditions, which are very strong up in the north, and the original tribes and the Viking tradition, actually, and how they fought to expel the Romans.
Yes.
That's a very beautiful part of our history, and we aren't told that so often.
How's that in Norwegian schools, by the way? Are you allowed to talk about this, or is that encouraged, a history? I mean, I know that there's a couple of, like the Ostfold ship, for example, in Norway, very famous, a beautiful old Viking ship and whatnot. But in Sweden, I remember growing up, we heard more about Napoleon and the Roman Empire and all these other countries, what happened there, as opposed to our own history and our own, I mean, the way we've been culturally severed in I would say Scandinavia, but I can only speak in this regard for Sweden, have been tremendous, and the way that it's been associated with all kinds of nonsense like racism and everything else, where I think it's been very efficient for them to cut us from that. I mean, the Viking strain has a natural rebellious tendency to it to that extent. I mean, for example, we mentioned this to you earlier, the concept of the ting was one of the oldest, not democratic versions, because democracy is still kind of representative as it came out of Greece, but free men and women in pre-Viking and post-Viking Scandinavia they could speak for themselves. You know, they could gather at these sites where they had the stone circles and talk and you know, speak for themselves and cast a vote for an issue that was to occur. That the tradition, therefore, of that type of government is quite unique on a historical basis. Actually, people don't know about that, but you know.
Yeah, what you see in school is actually a very powerful dumbing down of us, all of us. And I feel in my own case how much I've had to struggle to make my way through all of the veils or all of the belief systems imposed upon me. And we are taught history in a very fragmented way as events, with dates that we are supposed to repeat in very conform ways, and we can't connect the dots, not at all. So we are never taught how to connect the dots and how to see the deeper truths. So that's something that has come when, as an adult, actually, and many of us are now spending so much time trying to connect these dots, trying to make sense of missing pieces of our history that we've never been told. And the force with which the Vikings actually met the Romans is something that should have a tremendous bearing. It's a very important point in our history, actually. But what I believe is that the Roman tradition, or the Vatican now, these days, holds the actual power through the Jesuits and through the Masonic lodges in our countries, which is why we never learn or we never hear about these things, because the Romans have come back in more occult ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's that legal framework of the of papal bulls and everything else. Something people forget of many, you know, thousands of years that go back, basically, as they were trying to, you know, claim the whole world. But one of the battles that people can read about is the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest, and that's basically in northern Germany, where a lot of Germanic tribes gathered because they realized that the threat of the Roman Empire. And they managed to hold them back, which was a huge defeat by the Romans. And after that point, they actually realized that, you know, they were trying to kind of, okay, if you can't beat them, let's try to join them. So they actually entered into an interesting relationship to it after that. They never dared to come up here, of course, and try to claim it. That's why that never happened. You got a period where you had more freedom of culture as well in the northern countries for a longer period than they did in the rest of Europe. You know, outside of that Roman framework. But nonetheless, I think it's a really interesting, you know, story that actually, you know, brings up a different kind of flavor to it. But the Romans had definitely been an advantage. And then later on, of course, when Christianity came in as well, that was also seen as an invader. And that might be one of the, we talked with this about, with Stephen McNallan, by the way, in terms of the more of the Viking Age and all that, that the raids that you see was most likely that one and only reason for those and the violent raids was because it was a response and a reaction to the incoming and threatening to the people Christianization of the northern lands, you know.
And for me, I've just recently actually been diving a little into the mythology and the beliefs of the Vikings, because we've never been taught this in school.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I was so surprised to see the depth and the transcendence of the teachings or of the beliefs and the depth of the spirituality that they had, the things they believed in. I really had no idea at all. So it's as if our understanding has been so brutalized throughout recent history that these notions that were so advanced and run so deep within our psyche. These are not familiar to us at all, because we are taught basically very superficial stuff in school.
Yeah.
So we can only recognize reality on kind of a very superficial level.
I mean, it needs to be rediscovered by the people in Northern Europe, no doubt about it. It needs to be revived again. I mean, it's all there. I mean, people... they run to Hinduism or Buddhism, or they run to some kind of New Age theology and whatnot. But it's like you have a tradition right there, which is beautiful. It's connected to yourself, to your own people, through your blood. You know, it's like it's a huge shame that they managed to do this. But again, we talked about this before we began the second hour, Ingun, and I think it has to do with the fact that there is a spirit of rebellion within that tradition that is very, very the people, the mechanism of control, rather, whoever the people actually are who are trying to enforce that mechanism at whatever given time in history, know that this is something that cannot be awakened or associated in any way again. Therefore, do not teach it in school. Tell them that they were all barbarians and it ends there. They were just violent, brutal people and that's it. As opposed to really giving them the full story and the real mythology, the real tremendous... I wouldn't say religious, but spiritual tradition that resides within those, you know, within the mythology itself. So I think that's why one of the reasons why they did such a tremendous experiment on the northern countries as well, Ingun, the way that they wanted to create this kind of political laboratory, try to subjugate the people under control, because it was one of the small countries, small populations. So it's simple, of course. It's more easily applicable. But it's also for a much, much, much deeper reason, I believe, because they didn't want any of this outbreak of this type of energy, if you will, to burst onto the world scene again, because that would be detrimental to them, you know?
That's a very good point, and I never thought about that. But that we have, as a matter of fact, become so subdued, and it would be wonderful if we had access to this force again. And I think we, as it seems to me, we are aided on all levels, also spiritual levels, in bringing forth what might be termed revolution. But what this revolution is rather changing the focus from the state and back to the people and back to the grassroots and to where the real loyalty lies. Because we are always told that our loyalty should be with the state, and if we aren't loyally paying taxes, for instance, we are also letting down community. And we must be ruled, because without being ruled, we are barbarians. That's the slogan or the mantra that is being repeated all the time.
Yeah.
So I can see that there is a growing grassroots consciousness, a feeling that the real brotherhood is our force, and that's where we derive strength from, and that's where the beauty lies, and that's where the focus goes. And this might be the way of reducing the state's power, because the state has reached the point where it's imploding upon itself, because it has applied so much force, brute force, towards the people, the normal people, on the grassroots level. And then up comes flowering, a new consciousness that actually makes us remember that we are brothers and sisters and co-creators. So somehow we might be reverting to something we've lost, something we've had before. But it seems to be springing forth very naturally.
I don't think it's something that can be held back, and it has been for a few thousand years. What people forget too, though, is that we are talking about traditions that have existed for, I mean, if not tens of thousands of years, thousands of years, and this is prior to the subjugation of the Roman system, which was a measure of control, and with that came the state religion of Christianity, and a lot of these traditions were branded as pagan and heathen and evil and brutal and barbaric and all the rest. We know the story now. But the fact is that this is something, if this is a tradition which is tied to the lands and tied to the people, this is something that exists within there. This is not something that's going to go away. Even if one believes in genetic memory or whatnot, it's still something that is tied into the cultural psyche, if you will, and you just can't eradicate that and expect it to go away forever. It's kind of like how other cultures have about their traditions and their gods, if they're Greek, the Greek gods, or whatever, however you want to view that. And the fact, too, I want to mention is that there are people think, oh, well, we don't know anything about that or whatnot. There are hundreds of texts and stories from this time. There's been so much written consequently as well by so many scholars and researchers that have taken what has been available in these stories and traditions that have been passed down primarily through the Icelandic scholars and the skalds, those who were the bards basically singing about this and writing about it too. But, the gods of the Viking Age, in Northern Mists, there's hundreds of excellent books written about the subject. So if people want to find out, that's all I'm saying. It's there. It's just that we don't know it's there,
But it also seems to be part of our cell memory or deeply embedded in our psyche, because I really hadn't given this so much thought, but I have seen that lately very many Viking societies or societies or get organized and reverting to or honoring the Viking tradition so much more. So this is actually being brought to light again by many people.
Beautiful. Well, I think that's a really positive note to all of this as well. And I do hope that we can achieve something like that. It needs to be done, because, again, to people who don't live in the northern countries and understand the true nature of the silent tyranny that exists there, the quiet, subdued kind of imprisonment, if you will, very much on the psychic level primarily, that it's difficult to convey that, and it's difficult to explain really the nature of there. But it is there, it does exist, and the fact is that something needs to occur there before things just go too far and too out of hand. Otherwise, we're looking at a population completely under the control and subjugation of the state, and it feels like it could go a little bit either way there, Ingunn. But is there anything else you'd like to round things up on here before we begin to wrap up for this time? Ingunn, something you want to leave us with, something else? I mean, obviously, we want to hear about your websites again, where people can go to follow your writing. I know it's primarily in Norwegian at this moment, but nonetheless, it's there and you have it. So please tell us about it.
The name of my website is sigurdsdatter.com. And as we speak, it's being translated into English also, so you'll soon be very welcome to come visit my website. And I'm so happy to come onto this program because it's part of uniting us and tying us into a web of brothers and sisters around the world, connecting on a different note than before. So I'm very grateful for the invitation to come onto the program. And if anyone wishes to contact with me, they are very welcome to do so. So you'll find my email and my contact info on my website.
Very, very good. Thank you, Ingunn. Stay brave, of course. And please keep us posted again. We'd love to talk more with you and see how the developments go and just stand your ground and, you know, find that spot within yourself and call upon the greater force, if you will. And I don't think they'll stand a chance. Much more coming in the next few days. Chip Tatum and Ulla Damegård, Robert Morningstar, Richard Duchesne, and many more are coming on the program. We have a full list of our upcoming guests in our radio archive at redicecreations.com and also on our members' website, redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up to catch the full program and dig into our deep archives with a lot and lot of material for you. I hope you have some new material to consider today. We want to say thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you in just a few. In the meantime, stay sharp and stay healthy, and have a good day. Take care.